Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mealer here. Great to have you along today as we welcome back a couple of our regular guests on the show. Kevin Schessel, one of them, the Ag Development Educator for UW-Madison's Division of Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties. Kevin, good to see your face.
Hey, you too, Larry. Thanks for having me on.
Diana Alpeth with us as well, the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. And Diana, it's good to see you and those horses that you have in the background of your
The backgrounds on these Zooms and things can be pretty creative, but it's great to be here to talk about gardening on this frigid Wisconsin winter day.
Yeah, and tell you what, as we talk with Kevin and Diana, I hope you'll join in the conversation. We're going to be talking about these possible seed shortages, what to do about it, and of course, we're going to take any of your other questions, plant-related, gardening-related questions as well. And you can join in easily enough. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's take a look back at last year. Did you experience, let's start with you, Diana, did you experience any seed or plant shortages in your area last year?
Yes, there were quite a few things that happened last year. Obviously, with the pandemic, there was a bursting out of interest in gardening, people being home more, worrying about food availability, things to do with the family while everybody was at home. There were lots of reasons for it, but the seed companies and the greenhouses were a little caught off guard last year because they start planning all of that stuff well in advance of March when everything, the demand really jumped up. So a lot of seed companies, they ran out of some seeds or they had seeds in bulk but not packaged up for sale. And I know that a lot of the greenhouses around here, they weren't sure how the pandemic was going to affect things, so they didn't grow as much in some cases, and in other cases they just sold out so fast. So it was really, really hard locally to find transplants and starts in the greenhouses even early in the growing season. And hopefully this year things will be a little better.
Yeah. Yeah, you'd certainly hope so. Kevin, do you have the same problem in your area?
Yeah, I guess I would echo what Diana has said. I mean, this past year has been very unusual for all kinds of reasons. And we saw changes in behavior and people, you know, doing things that normally aren't predicted. And that's what most businesses rely on, is that past experience. And they do the best they can to meet that demand. And, you know, there was a huge spike in that demand. And, you know, it's a supply chain issue as much as it is a delivery and just having stuff available. And just like the grocery stores, you know, it's like, well, why did toilet paper fly off the shelf and, you know, and other items not? And, you know, and it's just the reaction and the emotions that got involved with all this. But it's a good, I think it's a good thing that we really got people's interest back into, you know, gardening and where their food comes from. And it's like, hey, I've got maybe some time now, or whatever the reason for that increased demand was, it can only be, I think, beneficial in the long run, because so many of us, at least in our area, you know, Diana and I are super passionate about this topic. There's a whole bunch of people that have gotten away from plants and nature and where their food comes from. And, you know, just having a simple garden in your backyard or a potted plant is so, I think, so important that we don't forget some of that stuff. And gardening is a great way to you know, get reengaged. And hopefully, you know, this, like a lot of things from the pandemic, we see some good things that come out of this, and we'll see where this season goes and how the supplies hold out. But
I wonder if they go ahead, Diana.
Oh, I was just going to say one thing to keep in mind is that in a lot of cases, the seed companies, like I said, they have enough seed, but you might go online to place an order and it'll say, we're not taking orders right now. And some of these seed companies, because of the high volume of orders, they just can't keep up. They don't have enough staff to actually package them and ship them. So they'll put, some of the companies will put a hold on taking new orders just so they can catch up with things. And also, so that they can go in the back room and package up some of the varieties that have sold faster because they aren't sure what's going to sell. They can only have so much supply packaged up. So, you know, if you face that situation, if you're out there trying to order your seeds, the advice is order early. A lot of people have already gotten their seed orders. So don't wait too long because there may be a delay in them getting your order shipped. And you want to make sure you have everything. Once this frigid weather breaks and we can start gardening, you want to be ready to go, right? So order early and be prepared that some things might be out of stock or temporarily out of stock, but you might be able to get them in a couple of weeks once they get things packaged up again. Also have, be flexible to take some kind of substitution. A lot of the companies will actually have a place in the order where you can check that you will allow substitutions and then they'll substitute something similar for it. Otherwise, be prepared for you to have a backup variety. Shop around because some companies have more of one thing than another company has. And again, the biggest thing is be flexible and shop early so that you can get what you want.
You know, I was just thinking this is, go ahead, Kevin.
No, go ahead, Larry.
Oh, I had a little aside question on this. I'm sitting here thinking about how they package these seeds up and I wouldn't want to be the one to count radish seeds into a pack.
Or lettuce, yeah.
Or lettuce. What do they do? Go by weight or?
They do. A lot of those small seeds, they'll be like a quarter ounce or a half ounce or they're packaged more by weight rather than number of seeds. But some things are by number of seeds. There'll be 20 seeds in a packet or 30 seeds. And you have to have tiny little fingers to count those out and package them.
Oh, man.
Yeah, just a follow-up to what Diane said about ordering seeds. I mean, with the internet and online shopping and all that we're accustomed to much more now than in the past, just need to be aware of the source of where you're getting your seeds from and make sure that you're just doing a little bit due diligence to make sure that these are reputable companies. And we certainly want to be buying things from within the U.S., there shouldn't be a big difference in whether you're buying it from the East Coast or West Coast when it comes to most of our seeds. But, you know, there's a lot of nefarious things that can happen online. And I know last spring there was this mysterious shipment of seed packets coming to people's doors from China. And that caused all kinds of consternation. And it was, I don't know what ultimately became of that. But, you know, you just need to be aware. Stick with companies that have, a good reputation. Do your due diligence. And, you know, certainly nothing wrong with buying local, going to the local greenhouses or other stores to buy packaged seeds. But, you know, if their inventories aren't what you're looking for, then you're almost always forced to go through a mail order catalog, which there's plenty of those out there too. So just a reminder.
Yeah, Diana, to add to that.
One other thing to keep in mind is you can save seeds from year to year. So if you have some seeds left over from last year, as long as they were stored correctly, they should germinate pretty darn well this year. So you can do a little germination test where you take a few seeds and put it in a damp paper towel, put it in a Ziploc bag on your kitchen counter and see how many of them germinate. So if 8 out of 10 germinate, you know that you have an 80% viability, and you might plant those seeds a little heavier than you normally would, but you can still use those seeds if they've been stored correctly. And keep that in mind. We don't know what the future will bring, but next year we might find ourselves in the same situation where it's difficult to get your hands on the kinds of seeds you want. So if you are ordering this year, you might order a few extra and then hold them till next year so that you don't run into the same problem next year. There's also, of course, the possibility of saving seeds from your crops if they're open pollinated and non-hybrid plants. You can save some seed yourself. There's a few things that you want to be careful about. So you want to make sure that you don't save seeds from plants that have had diseases, because those diseases can be carried over on the seeds. And there are some treatments you can do, and you know that can get a little more involved than what we want to talk about right now. But the point is that if you have some seeds left over from last year, they can still be useful. And if you find a source for one of your favorite ones, you might order a little extra so that you're set for next year.
Yeah, it makes good sense. You can join in, too, with your questions. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@WPR.org. And Nate in Eau Claire has a question that relates right to this. So let's go to Nate. Nate, thank you for calling.
Hi. I guess I had a second question also, but my first question is, what is a good resource as far as purchasing seeds online? I've always just gone to Menards and picked up the Burpee seeds. And I guess my second question is, what's the shelf life? How long would a seed typically last? How many years before it goes dormant? Thanks, I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Well, Diana, do you want to take that?
Sure. So if you obviously are one of the few people in Wisconsin who have not gotten on the mailing list of all the seed catalogs, because most of the time, if you have ever ordered seeds online, you will end up with a mailbox full of seed catalogs. And there's, you know, the most common ones are Johnny's, Territorial, Burpee, Park, Gurney's, and our local Wisconsin one is Jung Seeds, they have a lot of great things too. So if you kind of just get online and Google garden seeds, you'll be finding a lot of good sources. And like Kevin said, make sure it's a reputable source. So, you know, look at the about section on their website and make sure they've been around a long time, because a lot of these seed companies have been there 100 years already, and they wouldn't be in business if they weren't doing well that way. And there's nothing wrong with just going to Menards and buying things. It's just that they're going to have a limited supply of varieties, and they will usually have kind of the tried and true varieties. So you know, that's definitely, depending on how big your garden is, that would be just fine. As far as how long seeds will remain viable, there is some variability based on the type of seed. So whether it's a tomato or a squash or a cucumber, that sort of thing. But most seeds are going to be able to, every seed packet, when you get a seed packet, it will say on there packed for, and then the year that it was packed for. So they have to do germination tests and make sure that there's good germination before they can sell these seeds and stuff. And you can assume that every year the germination of those seeds is going to go down slightly. But if they are stored correctly, and what we mean by stored correctly is cool and dry conditions, those seeds can last a couple of years or even up to 10 years. Now, I wouldn't count on them lasting 10 years, but definitely, I mean, I've planted 4-year-old bean seeds and cucumber seeds that are several years old, and tomatoes. And like I said, you will have less percentage of germination, but most of them can last at least a year or two if you put them in a nice, cool, dry condition. So not in your hot garage, but some people will have them stored in a bag in the refrigerator, or, you know, if you have any other place that's going to be, again, cool and dry. You don't want them to get moist.
There you go. Thanks so much for that question, Nate. Appreciate it very much. Diana Alfuth, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. Kevin Schesso, Ag Development Educator for UW-Madison Division of Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties, our guest today. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234 or email at ideas@WPR.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk and the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guests, Diana Alfuth and Kevin Schesso. Great to have them back. And certainly, if you have questions, we've been talking quite a bit about seeds and potential seed shortages to start the show, but we'll take other questions as well, certainly, at 800-642-1234 or email at ideas@wpr.org. Take another call. Sarah in Zion, Illinois. It's your turn. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Okay, thanks so much. You know, first of all, I want to share that I found some basil seeds that I'd had in my fridge for 5 years. I just found them, and they, like, I decided to sprout them just to see what happened. They all sprouted. I couldn't believe it. So anyway, about seed saving. I was just reading, I mean, I do that occasionally and things resprout, and I was just reading a farmer was, we were talking about seed saving on the social media site, and he said, oh, it's, unless you've got a huge plot, it's just not going to work because you need enough diversity, and if you only have a few plants, your seeds are just going to be all the same, and eventually it just won't work. It's a disaster. So I just wonder what you think about what he said.
Oh, Kevin, you want to chime in?
Sure, I'll give it a shot. I guess, you know, there's always devils in the detail when we talk about this subject, because Diane already mentioned that, you know, certain plants and varieties, if you will, are more suited for seed saving. And if we're saving seed from a hybrid, we are less likely to have that resulting seed from that, you know, a hybrid fruit come true to what the original hybrid was. So the best seeds to save are from what we reference as open pollinated. Sometimes that's referenced as the heirloom types. So, you know, the open pollinated plants tend to self-pollinate, meaning the pollen falls right back onto the female parts of the flower, and you get kind of this inbreeding. So you're going to get the resulting, you know, fruit and characteristics that are pretty much true to the parent plant. So, you know, that's the first thing to keep in mind. There's some plants that are well suited for saving, you know, tomatoes and peppers being, you know, two vegetables that are relatively easy, and you don't have to worry about a lot of cross-contamination. But if you're talking pumpkins, or some of the other, you know, vine crops, you have a male and a female flower that are in separate parts of the plant, and requiring on insects to move pollen to, you know, fertilize that ovary. That's when, you know, you can have more challenges in that cross contamination of, you know, other pollen from other varieties. And if that's the kind of mystery you want in your seedlings, when you go to plant that seed, you know, it can be a lot of fun. It can be interesting. But again, you have to go back to understanding why you want to save seeds in the first place. And, you know, what's the purpose of that? And then how do you go about it? So I would stick with those plants that are more self-pollinated start saving seeds with those. And if you want to save seeds from other plants, just beware that that cross-pollination can happen, and you're not going to necessarily get the resulting fruit the following year because of that cross-pollination, you know, different parents. And, you know, it's fun to do, and there's a reason to do it, but a lot of times just go buy your seeds if you're so inclined, or, you know, start slow and learn as you go, and understand the science behind pollination.
As far as like needing a big plot, I would disagree with that. I think you can grow a heirloom tomato in a container on your patio and save the seed from year to year to year, and you're just fine. So I don't, I'm not sure what that person might have been referring to, that you need a big plot or it'll be a disaster, because I, as Kevin said, as long as you're doing a open pollinated sort of a thing, one plant is all you need.
There you go, Sarah. Thank you so much for calling. Well, let's turn to Chris in Mercer next. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to, I guess, make a comment as far as seed saving goes. About 5 years ago, a friend had an idea of starting a seed library in our local public library. And partly because she had heard something on the radio about certain states not allowing it, and that, you know, big companies like Monsanto had gotten involved. Anyway, bottom line is she recruited me to help her, and we started by just collecting our seeds, basically simple tomatoes, peppers. And part of the reason was here in Mercer, we can't get a pepper to grow to be red. I mean, it's really hard. And so we thought, well, if we keep growing our own, that it becomes accustomed to our climate, and maybe eventually we could do that. We still haven't mastered the pepper thing, but our tomatoes have done really well. They do ripen a little earlier. We've been at it 5 years now. And it's basically her and I supplying the seed library with all the plants that produce annually, the biannuals, like carrot and what else? Off the top of my head, carrot's the one. But those we tend to purchase. And we just got together on Tuesday to go through our seeds because she had heard there was going to be a shortage. And we actually did have trouble last year. You know, we hadn't planned for the pandemic, and we were out of seeds, like, right away. And so we hadn't expanded our gardens to produce more seeds, so we were going to order a little bit more to provide it at our seed library. And we found that cucumber is already in short supply. We could only get one pack of cucumber. What else was? There were a few others that were in short supply. But
already.
We only buy from trusted heirloom sources like Seed Savers, Baker's Heirloom, et cetera. And we've had really good luck, and all we ask is the seeds are for free. When anybody comes in, they can take them for free. And all
That's great.
Hey, if you can save a few, please bring them back. We'll take care of packaging them and everything else. But basically, our seeds are available to our community for free, and we've had a lot of help from our UW Extension agent out of the Hurley office. But like I said, we're in, I think, our fifth year, and it's been pretty
good.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Chris, for calling in. Maybe, Diana, do you have a comment?
Yeah, you know, seed libraries are not uncommon. There's quite a few of them set up. And, you know, the reference to some states not allowing it and stuff, there are concerns. You, of course, there are pros and cons to everything, right? And there are concerns with seed libraries because when you buy seeds from a reputable nursery, they've been virus tested and disease tested and that sort of thing. Unfortunately, when you save seeds from your garden, you can carry diseases on those seeds. And so some of the concerns with seed libraries is you could be spreading diseases. So for example, tomatoes. Tomato seeds can contain bacterial speck, bacterial spot bacteria. And so when people, you know, if your plant happened to have that and you save the seeds from it, now you put those seeds in a seed library, everybody who plants those are going to have those diseases. So there are concerns with disease spread and viruses and that sort of thing. And so that was more the concern when they were questioning about whether or not to allow seed libraries, because the, you know, Wisconsin Department of Ag tries to control diseases and stuff like that. So there are those concerns with it. And then there is also the, as Kevin was talking about earlier, if there were some seeds that cross-pollinated and now you're going to get frankenfruit out of those seeds. And like Kevin said, they can be fun, especially the vine crop things. You get some pretty funky looking things when they've been cross-pollinated. But, you know, it is kind of a buyer beware sort of a thing. If you are getting seeds from a seed library, you know, you got to be concerned about those things a little bit. And but on the other hand, you know, it is kind of nice to have a local source of saving seeds and getting seeds available, especially to people who, you know, have a hard time affording new fresh seed and that. So pros and cons, just things to consider.
Thank you so much, Chris, for calling. I appreciate your call. Let's take another call. Cal in Sugar Camp. We'll go to you. Hi, Cal.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I've gotten really unhappy with the petunia varieties that have been available the last few years. And I remember a couple that Fredonia Seeds Company used to carry, Giants of California and Fluffy Ruffles. And my sister has computer access, and she went looking for them, and she found them, and she ordered them. I think she was on the World Wide Web, and they came from the Philippines. And unfortunately, it came a little late for me to plant last summer, so I'm going to plant them this spring. But I was just astounded that these wonderful old varieties were still available somewhere. And next I'm going to start looking for the Royal Cascade and the White Cascade petunias because the perfume was so fabulous. But it's amazing what you can find out there.
Well, it is indeed, Diana. There's someplace with the web you can find.
Right, and that is the convenience of the web. And, you know, there are it's a great point. There are so many different varieties of annuals out there, and there's new ones released every year. The plant breeders are busy trying to get us the latest, greatest thing because we all want to spend our money on the latest, greatest thing, right? And so new varieties, new colors, new fragrances, but they can only stock so much and grow so much. And so some of these older varieties kind of fall out of the top of the list. And then they are only grown by some of these more obscure nurseries and growers. And so you really do have to go searching for them. But it's great when you have a favorite that really brings you joy and enjoyment. And so if you can get your hands on it, again, I'd buy two packets, not just one.
There you go. Thanks again, Cal. Appreciate it. Helen in Superior, it's your turn. Hi, Helen.
Hi. Actually, I'm up north of Superior, so I'm a foreigner, but I listen to your show all the time. And I don't have internet access at home, so I have to go mooching it. And I want to buy organic seeds, but last couple years when I go trying to search it, everybody comes up when you Google organic, but a lot of the companies, they'll have one, two, three varieties, and that's it. So I am wondering what companies have like a large variety of vegetable seeds in particular.
And organic. Okay. Kevin, do you want to try that?
Well, yeah, you know, and this is where, you know, we have to be careful, at least in Extension, that, you know, we don't get too much of an advocate for one business or company or, you know, idea over another. We kind of just, you know, be in the middle. I think you understand that, Larry. But Diane already mentioned Johnny Select. And for whatever reason, they're kind of one of the more common seed catalogs out there. And I know they have, you know, offered more of the selection to organic. The heirloom varieties and the Baker Creek and the Seed Savers and any number of other companies that are more into the heirloom type open pollinated varieties are also more heavily leaning towards, you know, organic types of, you know, of production. So, you know, again, the internet, you got to just do very careful searches and do your due diligence to make sure that, you know, you're comfortable with whatever pops up there. But unfortunately, it's just kind of the world we live in now, is that you go to the computer and you do a search, and as long as you're putting in the right words in the search box, you should filter out some of those that are, you know, probably not the ones you want to go to. So, you know, that would be, I guess, my general comments about finding things through the internet. And then, of course, you've got networks of growers and people that are into organics. You know, there's the Midwest Sustainable Organic Conference and that association of like-minded people. And if you seek out that organization, they'll have a lot of organic-specific stuff too. So,
yeah, there you go.
And one thing that we should mention is don't confuse organic and GMO. I get a lot of questions where people want to say, how can I get non-GMO garden seeds? Garden seeds are not GMO. They're not genetically modified. It's not like what the farmers are growing in the corn and soybean fields. So I don't know of any vegetable home garden seeds that are GMO. So don't, you know, fall into that marketing ploy of, oh, they're non-GMO. They're all non-GMO.
All right. There we go, Helen. Thank you very much for calling. And we have some open lines. Get you on pretty quickly here at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions or comments. Let's go to Mike in La Crosse next. Mike, hello. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi, Larry. Reason I'm calling it is I know how to save tomato seeds and squash seeds and most other ones. But, like, if you're growing cucumbers and you want to save for seeds, I mean, how big do you want them to get? You want them to turn, you know, get huge and turn yellow before you save the seeds? When should you do that and how?
Yeah. Diana?
Yep. You want your fruit to get ripe, fully ripe. And with a cucumber, that's when it's starting to look like a baseball bat and turning yellow and orange and that sort of a thing. So wait until that cucumber is starting to get a little mushy and far past when you would want to eat it. And then you're sure that those seeds are fully developed in there. And then, you know, if you've been saving seeds from tomatoes and stuff, you know, to remove all that slime and pulp and all that stuff and get those seeds dried out. But you do want those seeds to be fully mature before you save them, and that means orange cucumbers.
All right, there you go.
Yeah, and I'll just jump in. Just jump in here again. I don't like to keep promoting the internet and online, and I know not everybody is able to do that. But an internet search, I just did one on seed saving, and then I typed in extension, and there are like four extension fact sheets and websites related to this topic, University of Maine, Oregon, Colorado, University of Minnesota, North Carolina. And what I like about this source is that they're university research-based. They just give you the facts. They give some of the biology, the science, you know, why you need to do certain things and pay attention. And that's where we should start. And then from there, you can decide how do you want to participate and at what level and how detailed you want to get. But just be aware of some of the basic concepts. And that's kind of what we've been talking about all along. So, you know, take advantage of what the universities and extension services have put out, especially for the home gardening topic.
Yeah, it makes very good sense. So, again, what would you type into the search engine?
Well, I just typed in seed saving because that's our main topic here, and then extension. So okay. EXT, you know, and you know, extension is a land grant, you know, branch of every state, and every state has an extension department or service, and they put out their stuff. And I don't know quite how Google works or other search engines and bringing this stuff to the top of the search list, but. You know, if you're just careful in how you type in things, and not that the universities have all the answers, but for some of these basic concepts, they're a good place to start. That's all I'll say. I'm going to be biased, obviously, because I work for Extension, but I get it. You know, we're here to help provide research-based information that, you know, gives you just the facts, if you will, and then you can decide on whether you believe it or not, I suppose, but you know, just my perspective.
Go. Well, let's take Mike. Thank you, Kevin. And Mike, thanks for that question about how do you save cucumber seeds? Let's go to Grace in New Glarus next. Grace, hi.
Hey, Larry. Good to talk to you again. For folks looking for organic seeds adapted to northern climes, Nature and Nurture over in Michigan is a really great place. They grow a lot of their own seeds. They work on varieties, developing varieties that are specifically designed for growing in the Great Lakes region. and they have also a lot of varieties that were developed in Michigan, in Wisconsin, you know, places like that. So right now, yeah, Johnny Select Seeds is a great resource. Right now, they are only selling to farmers. They are not selling to home gardeners right now. But they have wonderful information on growing just about any crop. They particularly work with market gardeners and organic farms or sustainable farms. So they have tons of excellent information. As far as seed saving, Seed Savers Exchange over in Iowa is a fantastic place. They have heirloom varieties not just from North America but from Europe, and they have all sorts of great information on how to save seeds of different types of crops. There's a place in North Dakota, Prairie Road Organics. They develop a lot of varieties. The family's been over here for 150, 200 years. They have developed varieties of watermelon, of beans, of squashes, and anything that has Dakota in the name is one of their varieties that they have developed. So those are some really good sources for folks to start out with. Oh, there's another one called Great Lakes Staples Seeds. They have like Upland rice and all sorts of other neat crops. You can just get totally lost on their website and all the neat things they have.
Well, Grace, you've given us some good information here. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate it very much. Seed Savers Exchange is a fun place, that's for sure. And we've interviewed people from there in the past as well. Always a lot of fun. And that was, I think, some good information. Thank you so much. Joey emailed that he likes to use rareseeds.com. All their seeds are savable, which is Baker Creek seeds. And we'll have Jared Gettle on the program from there, from Baker Creek, on March 26th. So that'll be coming up for another show, for a Garden Talk show. So we are talking today and getting some great information from our two guests and from callers, as a matter of fact. But Diana Alfith, a UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. Kevin Chesso, Ag Development Educator for UW-Madison's Division of Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, Diana Alfith and Kevin Chesso. It's great to have them back. And certainly they are more than interested in hearing what your questions might be, and I hope you'll join in. We've talked a lot about seeds, but we can take other questions as well at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Greg in Westfield has tried various methods to start seeds indoors, and he's wondering what recommendations you have for equipment and supplies for starting seeds indoors in south central Wisconsin. He has some south-facing windows, but none with a decent windowsill. What does he have to have, and what other things would be nice to have for starting seeds? And I think that's a good question. Diana, do you want to chime in?
Sure. So some people get really into seed starting and have elaborate setups, but you can start with just the basics and do well with starting seeds. So the first thing I will say is if you don't have an elaborate setup, just be absolutely sure you don't start your seeds too early. because you don't want those seedlings to be overly mature and suffering from indoor conditions before they're able to get outside. So in South Central, we're looking at maybe May 15th for planting things outdoors like tomatoes and peppers, those warm season crops that we start inside. Earlier than that for the cool season, things like broccoli. But start your seed 6 to 8 weeks. Let's talk tomatoes. 6 to 8 weeks before that. So we're talking about middle of March. So don't get too anxious on starting them earlier. All you need for the basics is some kind of container that's about 2 inches deep. And I use a lot of recycling things like restaurant carryout, clamshells and stuff like that. They work great for that. Use a sterile seed starting mix. And that's really important. So invest a couple of bucks for a bag of sterile seed starting mix at the store. If you just use potting mix or something reusing, you're going to have disease organisms in there that can kill your baby seedlings through damping off a little a disease that gets a lot of seedlings. So make sure you use a sterile seed starting mix. Make sure it's damp before you plant your seeds. So get it nice and moist. Fill your containers. Put your seeds on top. Cover them with a little bit of the seed starting mix. And the rule of thumb is the seed should be planted about 1 to 2 times its smallest diameter deep. Okay. So if it's a 1/8 inch diameter seed, you would cover it with 1/8 to 1/4 inch of soil. Then you want to make sure that seed is moist. A mist bottle is the best thing to do so you don't dislodge the seeds. Cover it with plastic. That's where the plastic domes come in. But again, you can use recycled things. You can use plastic wrap tented up over it. You can put it in a plastic bag. All that dome does is keep the surface from drying out and keep the seed from drying out, because once that seed gets wet, it needs to stay wet till it germinates. But then as soon as you start seeing the speck of green that those seeds are germinating, take them out from under that plastic, because otherwise it's too humid down there and that can get too hot and encourage diseases. So get them out from under that plastic and then in the brightest light that you can have. Now, if you have a south window, you can grow decent seedlings. But it's better if you do some kind of artificial light setup. And you can get just a tiny fluorescent, or there are LED lights now, and set it on a table, get your plants underneath them. You want that light source to be no more than 4 inches above your growing foliage, and leave it on for about 18 hours a day. If you are just growing on a windowsill, you know, if you can set a chair, if you don't have a deep enough windowsill, if you can set a table or chair in front of that south window, your plants will lean towards the window or towards the light. So just make sure you turn them every day. Keep things watered, but not too wet. So you want the surface of that soil mix to dry out slightly before you water. Lots of seedlings die from overwatering, but you don't want them to wilt, obviously. And once they get their first set of true leaves, you can start with an every other week diluted fertilizer. Liquid fertilizer works best. Otherwise, you can put some slow-release granules on the soil surface so that those little seedlings are getting all the nutrients they want. The best temperature to grow seedlings in is going to be in the mid to upper 60s with bright light. And when your seedlings are getting long and lanky and stretchy, that means it's too warm and too dim a light. So you want the brightest light without too warm conditions, and you can grow super nice seedlings inside. So that is the little basic summary. And really, again, it's simple. Don't make it too complicated. You can make it more complicated by adding bottom heat for those seeds to germinate. So there are seed starting mats, or if you have in-floor heat, if you set those containers on ground, the soil, and speed the germination, you can do all kinds of fancy shelving things and stuff. But plain and simple, if you just provide those basics, you will be able to grow good seedlings indoors.
I wanted to bring up that Extension has a new survey that it's starting up, and I'm not sure. Diana, do you want to talk about that?
Sure. So, you know, with UW Extension, our mission is education, of course, and we are always trying to help the residents of Wisconsin with their lifelong learning needs and to be successful in things. And of course, Wisconsin Public Radio has a similar mission, and we do a lot of needs assessments. We offer a lot of activities and classes and events and publications, including coming on Garden Talk and helping answer people's questions. But in order for us to do our job well and to make sure that we're hitting the mark, we need to hear from people occasionally. And so what we have started here is we're trying to implement a little survey that we would like your listeners to help us with. It's just on the internet, and the website is just go.wisc.edu/radio. It's a tiny, tiny little survey where we're trying to gain some feedback just to see if the listeners find it valuable for us to be here and what we're doing, if you're learning something, if what you've learned is going to result in maybe you doing something differently, and then also what other topics related to horticulture you would like more information on. So that might help us with getting an expert or an extension specialist on this program, or doing some other classes or resources to help people with their needs. So we're first kicking off this survey today. And again, either now or when the show is over, we'd really appreciate it if people could go on. It will take you all of about 2 minutes. It's a super short little survey. But it will help us to do our jobs better and to meet the needs of everyone better if we can get some feedback. So again, that's at go.wisc.edu/radio.
go.wisc.edu/radio. Yeah, and please help us out with that. We'd love to have you participate. We'll probably post that up on our page as well, ideas@wpr.org/Larry. A lot of people know to go to that, and we can put that in our notes section, and you could just click on it. But it's go.wisc.edu/radio. Well, Matt in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Matt.
Hello. One thing I would like, or maybe it already exists, to see the UW have would be a vegetable disease and mineral deficiency identification guide. Full disclosure, I grow plants to sell in the spring, and I get lots of my neighbors who come back and ask, hey, what's wrong with my tomato, pepper, petunia, whatever. And I rely a lot on commercial, you know, fertilizer dealers and whatnot who have developed wonderful pictures for certain crops. Like, if you see this, add this. Or if you see this, treat with this. Does the university have something similar for the general public to use?
Yeah, that's a good question. And Diana, do you want to go there?
You know, I can't off the top of my head think of what we have that would have like all the pictures and stuff. And of course, there are, when you get into nutrient deficiencies and things, there are a lot of similarities. And a lot of times it's not a matter of an actual nutrient deficiency in the soil, but something else like a bad pH that's not allowing that plant to take up a particular nutrient. And so it's not as simple as just matching a picture, but we have to start with some soil tests and do some diagnosis that way. But I'm not sure, and Kevin, maybe you know more about what we might have for commercial growers. So we have a lot of publications. Some are geared more towards commercial growers, and some are geared more towards home growers. And of course, there are other extensions. We try not to recreate the wheel if some other extension services have some really good things. So I am imagining that somewhere there is something like that out there, but I don't know where
sure.
it is off
Kevin,
the top of my head.
Kevin?
Yeah, again, it's hard to be all things to all people and meeting those needs and all the different requests that you know, the public has, you know, and this is one of those topics that it would be nice if there was just this wonderful library of photos that was organized in a way that the average person could, you know, do some of that comparison. And I know they're out there and they're on somebody's website. We've got wonderful specialists that do this kind of work, either in our soils department or in the horticulture world on campus. And there's lots of information on these various deficiencies with pictures. Again, you just have to do your due diligence. And you know me, Larry, I'm always talking about critical thinking and horticulture CSI, you know, crime scene investigation, whether that's the best word to use or not. But, you know, we can't just take everything at face value and say, oh, I've got these spots or stripes or yellowing on my plant. It must be a nutrient deficiency. It very well could be, but we just, again, need to do our due diligence and asking some of those basic yes, no questions to get to a point where, all right, I think I need to go in this direction and research a little bit more. And like Diana said, you know, plants get their nutrition mostly through the roots, and we need to start with that soil test. And then from there, just figure out, all right, is nutrition an issue here, or might it be something else? So,
Kevin Chesso and Diana Alfeth, our guests today. Diana, UW Extension horticulture educator for Pierce County. Kevin, ag development educator for Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. Our guests on Garden Talk for the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guests, Diana Alfeth and Kevin Chesso, back with us. Diana, UW Extension horticulture educator for Pierce County. Kevin's the ag development educator for UW Madison's Division of Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. So, what gardening questions do you have? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And I did want to mention that for the caller earlier who asked about photos and that sort of things, a couple of the areas where you go to their website and there's a lot of great information is the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW. And if you type that in, you're going to get some great photos. And you can also send them a photo and get a pretty quick turnaround on some information relating to what you may have as an issue. And the Insect Diagnostic Lab, of course, in identifying insects and that sort of thing. Both of those are very helpful sources from the UW, which do provide a lot of pretty good photos. So I did want to mention both those sources. We had some questions, email questions I wanted to get to, but also if you have a question you want to phone in, give a call. We've got open lines. Get you on real quick at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. So Steve emailed that he and his friends who are gardeners have decided to share seeds that they are buying this year. Lots of packets have dozens of seeds in them, more than any one person can use, and I think that's a good idea too, just to share those seeds with your neighbors or your friends. No doubt about it. Diana emailed to ask if you could talk about winter sowing, and Kevin, maybe you could talk about that. I'm not sure what winter sowing is they're talking about. It could be lawn seeds, it could be other seeds, but what about it, Kevin?
Well, and Diana, you probably have just as much to say on this as I do, but it might be in reference to starting some of these seeds that require what we call winter stratification or vernalization, where they go through this cold period and then like nature would. You know, the seeds fall to the ground in the fall, and then they go through that chilling period, and then you sow them. You know, or you're trying to, I guess, duplicate that. What nature would do in, you know, in your house or so that could be reference to that. And there's a lot of native plants and people take like a milk jug and they, you know, cut the top off and they'll put their seeds in there and they'll actually set it out in a garage. So it gets that cold chilling period and then bring it back in. Or maybe they just let it naturally germinate come spring. So that you've got it in its container and you can just pick those plants up now and move them. So it's just trying to work with nature and how she does that cold stratification. I don't know, Diane, does that seem like the reasonable?
Yep. And I think you're right, where winter sowing means different things to different people. But there's also, and you kind of touched on it, where you use like milk jugs or other similar containers and you can like cut a hole in them and put your seed starting mix in the bottom, put your seeds in there, and then you've got like a mini greenhouse that you can have outside as it gets warmer, not with what the temperatures are right now, of course, but it's another way to seed start, and you're actually starting them more outdoors than indoors because they've got that little protection from that container. So the winter sowing term can mean different things to different people.
Mike in Burlington, let's give you a chance. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about trimming oak trees. I'm kind of concerned about oak wilt disease getting started on them. And I have some chokecherry trees that are growing within the branches of the oak tree. And I want to cut down the chokecherry trees. And I know to avoid oak wilt, that you're supposed to wait until the Vikings are out of the playoffs before you trim your oak trees in the fall. But how late in the winter, spring can I go before I should not trim them or cut down the other trees?
If you go by the Vikings out of the playoffs, that gives you the whole year, right? You're absolutely right. You want to be careful of that oak wilt. Oak wilt is spread from tree to tree by insects that fly from an infected tree and then get to a healthy tree. So that's why we don't want an open wound available when those insects are out there flying. So that means that you can go pretty late, like at least through March, to be pruning your oak trees. If it warms up a lot in April, you know, we don't know when those first beetles start flying around and stuff. Kevin, the DNR always puts out the date, and I know they always say through July 15th. I always say, nope, not until it's freezing in the fall. But the early part, I think, is it April 15th that they start the oak wilt season?
Yeah, that seems about right. You know, again, when we come up with these general recommendations, you know, they have to take into account all the different users and the different industries. And, you know, up north with all of our logging industries or in the whole state, you know, we know that we can't be too restrictive in some of these guidelines for that reason. But you're right. We really want to reduce the risk of spreading disease. And anytime there's an open wound, it's going to be, you know, attractive to, you know, insects that are the vector to spread those things. So, you know, that's where, you know, those guidelines come into play for, you know, July 15th. By then, we're probably late enough in the growing season where those insects aren't as active, you know, that kind of thing. But sticking to dormancy is just a general good rule of thumb for at least homeowners. You know, if you don't need to mess with pruning in the summer months and during the growing season, just wait until the leaves have fallen off, you know, early fall, all the way through bud swell. Is kind of the recommendation I always give out is just let the tree go dormant. It's done its business. It's got all of the energy into the roots, and now it's not going to be as stressful. You know, there's nuances to pruning, as you know, but dormant pruning is always the best, in my opinion.
Yeah, and if it's me and I've got a homeowner and one or two trees, I'm probably going to err on the safe side. And I like that, you know, I'm no later, for me, it'd be no later than early March. Of course, that's That's my opinion, but I understand that there are general guidelines that need to be followed. So let's take a – and Mike, thank you very much. Let's go to Dave in Chicago next. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Larry. Hey, folks. Got a great show here. Hey, I called back in November, you know, about some hybrid salvias, and they told me to take them – you know, I pulled them out of the ground and put them in pots and – I put them down in the basement, and they're growing like 2-3 feet tall, but they're getting kind of leggy, and some of the bottom leaves are starting to die and fall off. So could I cut those new growth and, you know, keep them alive? Would that hurt them? Or?
Okay. Diana, what do you think?
So I'm assuming these are annual salvias because the perennial ones should be hardy here and stay outside. And yes, they're growing tall and lanky because they're not getting as much light as they would have outside. So you can, as we're getting closer here to being able to get them back outside, you can prune them back and you don't want to go all the way to the ground. You need to have growing points there and stuff. And then they will branch from below that and you can, you know, get them back into size. Now would be the time then to start giving them a little bit of fertilizer because with the longer day length, they're waking up. And you can get them ready to go. And then what I would do is as soon as the daytime temperatures are above 50, if you can move them out during the day and back in so that they start getting acclimated outside, that would be really helpful. If they've got leaves on them, you're going to worry about sun scorch. So don't just put them out in the full sun right away. You'll need to harden them off and get them ready to go and get them back outside as quickly as possible this spring.
So would you cut the maybe a third back or?
A third's always a good rule, yep. But you do have to kind of look at the plant carefully and see where there are branches and side buds and things that are going to shoot out with the new growth. So a third is a good rule of thumb, but you have to look at each individual plant and pick and choose what you prune off.
Yeah, kind of go from there. Thank you, Dave. Appreciate it very much. Becky in Ryle will go to you. Hi, Becky.
Hi. Hey, Kevin, I'm growing honeyberries, and I think you have experience with that. I love the idea of something with a blueberry that's not blueberries. I've had them in the ground for 4 or 5 years, and year before last, I had 2 berries. This last summer, I had a handful off of 3 plants. Do they take a long time to get going, or what can I do to help them produce?
Well, I'm glad you pointed me out, not Diana. I don't know why that was, but maybe it's because I've been on talking about fruit in the past. But whenever we have some of these minor fruit crops, and honeyberry would be one of those that we're not normally thinking about growing. It's just that learning curve that comes with any new variety and understanding. Again, you know, I always like to, you know, go back to the basics and not overthink things. And, you know, when it comes to bearing fruit, there's lots of things that come into mind when, you know, we say, well, why isn't my plant flowering, producing fruit? You know, you have to just make sure that plant is not stressed and not, because again, it needs to be happy in order to be, you know, fruitful. So, sometimes pruning invigorates flower bud production, or maybe it's, you know, the environment it's in, if it's not getting enough sunlight and stuff.
Oh, we lost you a little bit there, Kevin. The other thing that came to my mind was, of course, when I think about blueberries, I think about the soil itself, and it needs to be a little more acid, if I'm not mistaken. And I maybe Diana, we'll go to you on that for honeyberries.
Sure, and honeyberries don't need as low of a pH as blueberries do, but they are a shrub, and just like blueberries, you don't expect full production until 5 years. It does take them quite a long time to establish a good root system. So the fact that you got a handful this year versus only two the year before, you're in the right direction. But I would make sure that you've done a soil test. And even if you did one before you planted them, if they've been in the soil that long, we recommend soil tests every 4 to 5 years, because your phosphorus levels, your potassium levels, your pH can change in that amount of time. So maybe a good solid soil test to make sure that your basics are covered and your pH is in the right range for honeyberries. Honeyberries do like full sun, so hopefully you've got them in a nice full sun spot, because that can affect how many flowers you get and therefore how much fruit you get. And then once you have that stuff covered, then like Kevin mentioned, sometimes some pruning back can invigorate some new growth, and that's where your future fruits will come from. So that would be, I've never grown honeyberries, but that would be my first thoughts on what to do.
All right. There you go, Becky. Thank you very much for calling. Nels in Benton, we'll go to you. Hi, Nels.
Yeah, I had a question about tomato blight.
Okay.
I put up some new raised beds for my wife. Last year was the first year that we planted in them, and we ended up with some tomato blight on the plants. The dirt that I used to fill the beds was just some topsoil that I had brought in. They were pretty deep beds. And is there anything we can do early in the spring to help prevent that?
Sure. So I'm thinking you must be talking about what we call early blight, which is different from late blight, which wipes out your plants in a matter of days. And so this, what we so often refer to as early blight, is really a complex of several different organisms. And most of them are somewhat in the soil, and that's how they get transported. And they're common things out there, like septoria leaf spot and such. The thing to do with everybody who plants tomatoes, the way early blight gets started usually is soil splashing up. When the raindrops hit the soil, it splashes up on those lower leaves. It starts getting your spots and your yellowing on those lower leaves. It works its way up the plant as the year goes on. So we want to stop that soil splash. So the best thing that you can do is, as soon as you plant your tomatoes, and I'm talking within 10 minutes, don't wait on it, is to put some mulch down. And the best mulch to put it down would be either a layer of normal brown corrugated cardboard or about 6 to 7 sheets of basic newspaper, and then top that off with 4 to 6 inches of either dried grass clippings, straw, leaves that you collected the fall before, any kind of organic matter, stuff like that. Get it to within about an inch of the stem of the plant. And what that mulch is going to do is, when it rains, you will not be getting those splashes to get that started, and that will pretty, you know, knock back the majority of your tomato disease problems. It also means you don't have to weed, because any weed seeds underneath that mulch are not going to germinate anymore. And then the other thing is, make absolutely sure that you're watering the soil, not the leaves. So if we have break in the rain and you need to water your garden, do not use an overhead sprinkler. Your goal is to keep the leaves as dry as possible. And along with that, make sure you're spacing your tomatoes far enough apart and you're putting them in some kind of trellis or cage system. You do not want your plants to be touching when they're fully mature. So in August, they shouldn't be touching. You want good air circulation going in between those plants to keep the humidity down, because high humidity encourages these foliar diseases. So with all of those things, you might still get a little bit of tomato blight, but it's usually a race. It works its way up. We get our good harvest, and before the plant is totally wiped out by blight, it's freezing out there. So those things usually help you to get that blight under control. And then, of course, crop rotation. So you don't want to grow things in that tomato family, which include peppers and potatoes and eggplant, in that same area every year. You want to, because that those diseases overwinter on little leaves that fell into the soil and that sort of thing. So hopefully that'll help.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Nels. Appreciate it. Patricia in Spring Green. Hi.
Hi. I'd like to grow broccoli and broccolini, Chinese cabbage, Brussels sprouts, those kinds of things. I haven't gardened for about 50 years since I was a kid, and I remember the nightmare of cabbage worms and all this chewed up stuff when we were on our farm trying to grow cabbage and things like that. So I'm wondering if your guests have any advice for me, or if it's pretty much the same as it was 50 years ago with these kind of things.
Okay.
That, cabbage family.
Okay. So that is my favorite question, because I have the perfect organic solution for you. And that is called row cover. So if you don't know what a row cover is, it's basically a spunbound polyester sheet. Just Google it. Sometimes they're hard to find locally, but you can order them online. And again, as with all garden things, get them early. But it comes in different sizes. Usually it's like a 6 foot wide sheet and maybe 25 feet long. As soon as you plant all of those crops, because none of those crops need insect pollination, as soon as you plant all of those crops, if you drape this row cover over the top, sunlight gets through, water gets through, but those moths that lay their eggs that turn into those nasty little caterpillars you're talking about, they can't get there to lay their eggs. So you just are protecting them. You're creating a barrier. You don't have to spray. You don't have to pick them off your plate when you after you've harvested your broccoli and cooked it. And I just always tell everybody, row covers are the most underutilized, fabulous thing for these crops to prevent those problems. And you can usually reuse these row covers for a couple of years if you're careful, and check it out. It'll make life wonderful.
And it's relatively inexpensive too. That is for sure. I was thinking back to many years ago when I was trying to impress a date, and I was preparing a meal for her, and one of those worms happened to find its way into the salad. And of course, it wasn't my salad. It was hers. So it wasn't the greatest of all experiences date wise. Let's put it that way. Well, here we are running out of time, and run out of time, as a matter of fact, Diana and Kevin. I want to thank you both so much for being with us today. And before you go away, I want to remind people that we have that very short, take a minute or two to fill out this little questionnaire. You go online to go.wisc.edu/radio. And there's just taking a minute or two to fill it out. And it just concerns today's show. And we hope we get a lot of people do that. So go.wisc.edu/radio. And again, Diana and Kevin, thank you so much. We'll look forward to your next visit. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Larry. Anytime.
All right, Diana Alfa, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. Kevin Schesso, Ag Development Educator for UW-Madison's Division of Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties. Next week on Garden Talk, Neil DeBow will be back to talk about native plants, so we'll look forward to that. And our physical therapists join us on Monday. So we'll talk about how to make sure an injury of pain doesn't come back after you've managed to make it go away. So there you go. In the meantime, though, hey, there's lots more in store on the Ideas Network. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mealer.